Good afternoon. Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the court, Santino Chakotay on behalf of the appellant in this matter, William Griffin. This appeal comes from a denial of a motion for judgment of acquittal in the Superior Court on a charge of carrying a concealed deadly weapon. We make one argument in the court below which we make before this court, and that is that the Delaware Constitution's right to bear arms, in Article 1, Section 20 of the Delaware Constitution, restricts enforcement of 1442 in this instance. Specifically, in the issue that there's a home possession exception that this court explored in Dickerson back in 2009. Our contention is that the Superior Court erroneously denied Mr. Griffin's motion for judgment of acquittal on the carrying a concealed deadly weapon charge because the applicable statute that's involved, 1442, applies to carrying a concealed that occurs entirely on the defendant's private property. Now, our argument rests, as mentioned, in this court's decision in Dickerson versus State. The implication in Dickerson, which used State versus Stevens, an Oregon Court of Appeals case, as a blueprint for the Dickerson opinion, that voluntary departure from one's own residence places them outside of any home possession exception.
I don't want to sound like a lawyer, but you earlier used the term private property, now use the term residence, or perhaps we could call it a dwelling. For your argument, how narrow would this right be construed and be construed consistently with the right to bear arms?
Well, Chief, even more recent than the Dickerson opinion, I think this court did explore, believe in Feliciano, a case that counsel handled as well. In that case, the issue was what's home. The Superior Court, to answer your honest question directly, the Superior Court in this case found that Mr. Griffin, being a tenant, and living, cohabitating with his girlfriend in this property, was sufficient to consider it his home. So I'm not sure whether for purposes of this case, whether it's relevant as to what the court wants to define as a dwelling, residence, property. We do know that in this case, the state concedes that Mr. Griffin was home for purposes of the statute. So understanding that there's a home possession exception rooted in the Delaware Constitution requires to then determine, which is what this court found in Dickerson, as to whether the individual is voluntary or involuntarily removed from the home when the concealed deadly weapon charge attaches.
Was there procedurally a bill of particulars or anything that essentially required the state to pin down where the illegal carry occurred?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. What we do know is that the jury sent a note and was, it can possibly be inferred of their confusion as to where exactly the carrying the concealed took place, inside the home or outside the home. I think based on, again, the rationale in Stevens and Dickerson, the fact that Mr. Griffin was forcibly removed from by police, which the Superior Court found, puts him in the home possession exception and within the bounds of protection from the Delaware Constitution. The other main focus that the Court of Appeals of Oregon held, which again, this court cites in its Dickerson opinion, is that...
Well, just help me on the location. For purposes of this appeal and the motion filed before the Superior Court, the Superior Court took the position that the conviction was for carrying a concealed deadly weapon in the home.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct. And I think it's rather, it's rather clear that the alternative to the state's position in this case is a pretty chaotic situation with so many citizens having arms in their homes, let alone carrying a concealed deadly weapon. I mean, many of us probably engage in that, whether on a daily basis, whether we're in the kitchen, whether we're packing boxes, as Mr. Griffin testified he was, packing boxes and so forth. So to not have the home possession exception presents a rather, it becomes problematic for everyday citizens in their daily lives. And I think the reason the Court of Appeals of Oregon used was, assuming that people do carry concealed deadly weapons, they're moving them in their house from room to room, and what happens in situations like that? Then they're exposed to criminal liability. So that's the problem of not having the home possession exception. Now, this court assumed that home possession exception existed in the Dickerson case. Again, it didn't find there was a colorable claim because Mr. Dickerson was voluntarily left his dwelling or abode when he was searched. So that's essentially the argument in this case.
Let me ask you if there's any significance to the fact that the General Assembly, in creating this offense, calls it carrying a concealed deadly weapon. There is no felony of possessing a concealed deadly weapon. It's carrying a concealed deadly weapon. There's also no element that requires that it be with intent to commit a crime, strangely. Nevertheless, it's a felony. Does the option of selecting the word carrying as opposed to having in one's possession a concealed deadly weapon suggest that the General Assembly intended to criminalize conduct by a defendant who, with a concealed deadly weapon, moved from point A to point B, was transporting the weapon from one place to another with the inference that it may have been arguably for the purpose of committing a crime, and on that basis not even have to reach the issue of a home exception under the right to bear arms?
Assuming that it's implicit, Chief? Then
yes, it's not a term of art that's defined.
Correct.
But it also purposely doesn't use the word possession or possess, which suggests it's simply having it on your person.
Correct.
You have to go from point A to point B, and if you're in your home, you're not presumably going anywhere unless, as in this case, you're involuntarily removed from your home.
That's correct. That's correct. And another point to add regarding the Delaware version of the 1986 constitutional amendment is it's much broader than the Oregon version, which was used in Stevens and in Dickerson to explain that this home possession exception exists. The Delaware is broader than that. It talks about the right to keep and bear arms for self, family, home, state, and for hunting and recreational use. So it encompasses a much broader safety net for the possession of arms and deadly weapons. One of the Superior Court used the Hamden decision, the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision, to find, I guess, an exception to the exception of the home possession exception here, and that is that The Superior Court assumed there was a home possession exception, but tried to carve out a situation for Mr. Griffin that because it may have been for unlawful purposes or the context of the facts, that he doesn't get that protection. It doesn't apply to him. The problem with that rationale is that if we review the Hamden decision carefully, it actually addresses how to handle situations where there might not be a constitutional defense. And what they suggest is a couple of things. Number one, the burden is on the state to allege that the defendant used the specific criminal purpose when he carried the concealed deadly weapon, and present evidence that the defendant carried it for that unlawful purpose. So what we're getting at is an intent question. What was the intent in the situation? The Hamden court goes on to say that if those burdens are met by the state, so if they meet the first hurdle, then the trier of fact has to determine whether it was for that unlawful purpose.
But if we adopt the Hamden court approach, we would reverse and remand for a new trial with proper instructions. If we adopt the Stevens approach, we reverse. End of story. Is that right?
That's correct, Justice Richard.
Well, which should we do and why?
We, as in our papers to this court, we would, you know, our argument is to adopt the Dickerson/Stevens rationale used a few years ago. However, the second point that Your Honor makes is significant, because what the Superior Court did here was put himself in the shoes of the trier of fact. There essentially was a de facto non-jury trial on the issue of the carrying concealed deadly weapon. That issue should have gone to the jury, not written in an opinion post-trial. That's the problem in this case. And there was briefing on the issue, but the jury is also reflective of the fact that the jury was confused about this statutory provision about carrying a concealed deadly weapon and the fact that Mr. Griffin was home, because they asked him the question, what can you tell us about carrying a concealed deadly weapon in one's own home? And the option that the court took was to simply reiterate the jury instructions and tackle the issue post-trial. Well, by doing that, he's taking it out of the hands of the trier of fact. And what Hamden tells us is that's not what's supposed to happen.
Let's assume the police have a valid reason to enter a home, either to execute a warrant or whatever, and we adopt the Stevens rule that allows for carrying concealed deadly weapons. To pat somebody down under those circumstances, will there have to be a Terry analysis, or given that right, will the police be able to pat everyone down?
Terry should still apply. Fourth Amendment search and seizure law is still applicable. Certainly, we're not suggesting to put the officers in any danger. If there's reasonable suspicion, they can certainly conduct their Terry frisk.
Well, if you concede there was reasonable suspicion here because of the information that he was carrying a knife, pat him down.
To pat inside the home?
Yes.
The record reflects that there was a domestic dispute. There was mentioning of a knife. I believe they patted him down in the home and didn't find the knife. So they did execute that right.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the significance of patting someone down or not. Let's assume it's someone who has a permit to carry a concealed deadly weapon. There would still be circumstances under which it's rational for the police to pat people down before they take them into custody or before they execute a search warrant if the items for which they seek either include weapons or, as we have said repeatedly from this court, for whatever reason, drugs are automatically associated with weapons. So if they're searching for drugs, then it's rational to pat people down. Why does it make the only distinction is you don't arrest them for carrying a concealed deadly weapon when you find a weapon in their home, as opposed to when you forcibly remove them from the home or find them on the street or outside in the public place or whatever.
That's correct, Chief, and I think that is the main distinction with this case and why it's the ramifications of allowing or affirming this conduct, as I mentioned, is significant for the citizens of the state in general, because so many are probably carrying concealed weapons on a daily basis in their everyday life. And I mean, to sit here and go through a myriad of hypothetical situations where a cop could be at a home, it could be a prank call. I mean, what sense? I mean, in this case, sure, it was a domestic dispute. In Dickerson, it was a neighbor dispute. Who's to say there can't be a prank call? Cop shows up, all of a sudden, you know, he goes in the home and someone's carrying a concealed weapon. That type of conduct needs to be protected. And that's precisely what the Stevens decision outlines. That's what Dickerson outlines. It was only the fact that Mr. Dickerson was voluntarily left his home that this court mentioned that he did not held that he didn't have a colorable claim. And in this case, we have the exact opposite. He was forcibly removed from the home, and that's a significant distinction. Unless the court has any additional questions, I reserve my time.
Right, thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Timothy Donovan representing the state. If it pleases the court.
Are you content, Mr. Donovan, with the level of the podium?
There is a level. Oh. Thank you. I got the argument notice. I went around, took a poll of some of the deputies. Did you know that there is the CCDW statute forbids you from carrying a concealed weapon in the home? And the universal reaction was, what? And I talked to one of our deputies, and she was, well, wait a minute. My husband collects guns, and we have children. I mean, what am I supposed to know? No, we're going to keep them locked up and place like that. Fine. So it's looking at the old cases, of course. The Delaware courts were very adamant about it. I mean, we have the Gagliotta, and then there's the Delaware Criminal Code commentary goes through, and some cases that suggest that even carrying a weapon home from the gun store getting concealed is going to be a crime. And I know from my own gunning days that we were going to transport a weapon from someplace to someplace else to shoot skeet or something. You made sure that it was either visible in a gun rack in the back window, or you broke it down and made sure it wasn't accessible, put it in the trunk, something like that. But in the home, I mean, that baffles people. So Judge Cooch's approach here, which is based on Hamden, that is the as-applied approach, I submit is the correct one, that we have here two broad one broadly painted right, as constitutional rights always are, you have a right to keep and bear arms. Bear means carry, according to my definition. Then you have a broadly painted statute that says you can't carry or bear a weapon, an arm, that's concealed. Now, this court has addressed it first in for the licensing requirements in the 1441 and 1442, and said, well, this is a reasonable restriction on the broader right. The General Assembly didn't change the statute for licensing or for carry concealed when the 1987 or 8 amendment went through.
But you would concede, Mr. Donovan, you would concede, would you not, that what you just referred to as a restriction is a restriction only to the extent you can't get a permit if you can't find $50. Because there's no rational basis test to issue a permit to carry a concealed deadly weapon.
If, we do background checks, and I mean, the court will not issue a permit if you have a criminal record, I don't believe.
I think you better check the statute on that. You would discover that there's no basis for a Superior Court judge to turn down the permit if five citizens from your electoral district vouch for your law-abidedness, as it says, and you pay $50.
Well, in that case, then...
Now, if that's a rational, reasonable restriction, it baffles me.
Well, I mean, the court did, in Smith, uphold those restrictions. And that's the state of the law as it is. But I note that in the cases the court has addressed this, Smith, Feliciano, and Dickerson, those three cases, there was no violent confrontation to the police, with the police. I also notice in the two out-of-state, the other state cases, the Oregon case, Stevens, and the case in Hampton, that, again, there was no violent confrontation with the police involved. There was no violence involved, and that's the distinction that I think Judge Cooch bases the difference in this case. This is not a case where the police go into the home and say, well, Mr. Griffin, we have a capus for your arrest, and besides, your fiancé wants you out of the house, so we're going to arrest you and bring you with us. And Mr. Griffin.
Well, at what point in time within the home did the defendant violate the law?
Judge Cooch never specifies a specific time. I note that, according to the police officers, the violent confrontation, verbally violent confrontation, began when Mr. Griffin was still in the basement. That's when he started cursing.
But what is your position? When did he violate the statute?
That in the basement sounds good to me. I mean, he was instigating a violent confrontation with the police while he was in the basement. And he obviously knew that he was carrying a steak knife in his boot because he himself testified that he had been using it in the basement and then put it in, concealed it in his boot. So Mr. Griffin is instigating the violent confrontation with the police while he's armed and then comes up the steps and continues the violent confrontation, cursing the police and spitting at the police, all the while knowing full well that in his boot he has the steak knife. Now, there's conflicting testimony here, and Judge Cooch never made a credibility determination. The police testified. All right. We asked them where the knife was because they had received that in the broadcast that the complainant, whoever, whether it was the fiancé or the fiancé's mother, called it in, warned them that he had a knife. She thought he had a knife. He may be in possession of a weapon. So this is why two police guards and four officers came here, because of the mention of the knife, not just a domestic disturbance. So the police were concerned about this. And according to the police, when Griffin came out of the basement, they said, where's the knife? He said, it's in the basement. Two of the four officers then go in the basement, and the other two, again, there's another confrontation, violence. They finally get him handcuffed and drag him out of the house, and then
How is somebody to know when they violate this statute? Let's assume that before the police arrive, is it your position that by having the knife in the boot that he violated the law?
No, that is not the position of Judge Cooch, and it's not my position.
All right, so how does the average common person understand when they've now committed a violation of the concealed carry statute?
When you have a violent confrontation, when you resist arrest, basically, when you have a violent confrontation with the police while armed. That seemed to be Judge Cooch's decision.
You're talking about a physical struggle or a basically mouthing at them?
Well, in this case,
what you refer to as a violent verbal.
Well, this is very clearly Mr. Griffin was egging the police on. He did everything he could. I mean, he was spitting on them. He bit one officer, but that was outside the house. So Mr. Griffin was looking for a violent confrontation. At what point he resisted arrest and all of this? Well, it was after he came up that I think he got the physical confrontation when the police tried to handcuff him and then he was struggling. So that was clearly resisting arrest at that point. But definitely when he started struggling, when they tried to handcuff him, that's when the physical struggle began. And the police had a capias for his arrest, so he was definitely resisting arrest at that point. And at that point, he had the knife. Obviously, he was armed. Griffin, the police said, oh, where's the knife? He misled them. Two officers go into the basement. Griffin said, at some point there, I shook my leg and said the knife was in there, but then they just yanked me out of the house. Judge Cooch never made a determination of which of those was the most credible.
They patted him down, didn't they?
I'm sorry?
They patted him down before they arrested him.
They patted him down initially, and they missed it because it was inside the boot.
Because it was inside the boot.
They didn't look inside the boot. And matter of fact, it wasn't until they got to the hospital that the police found the knife concealed in his boot.
So once he was handcuffed, if there was nothing he could do to be compliant. If he had revealed, you handcuffed me before I could tell you or remove the knife from my boot.
When they could handcuff him, and I mean, at some point during this confrontation, well, first of all, obviously, he could have left the knife in the basement. Why he came upstairs with the knife in his boot, I have no idea, but Mr. Griffin was not acting entirely rationally here. The handcuffing certainly didn't prevent him from saying, oh, by the way, take this knife out of my boot. I mean, he can do that at any time. But he continued to...
If he had done that, would he have been in violation of the law at any time?
According to Judge Cooch, no. And like I say, I think Judge Cooch's analysis here is the correct one. That the as-applied approach here. I mean, you have to be practical about these things.
Tell us again exactly how it works. It's proper as applied to him because of what? The confrontation?
Because of the confrontation. Because this is a violent confrontation with the police. And as Judge Cooch points out, now, it's like one of the primary purposes of Section 1442 is for the protection of, not just protection of the public in general, but specifically for the protection of police when they're trying to detaining somebody or taking them into custody, because these kinds of situations often turn violent.
So, but going back to Justice Ridgely's question, how does the public know what they're going to do? Let's suppose someone is in their home with a knife in their boot, and the police come to the home. They're invited in, and they're having a conversation, and they're conducting an investigation. Then during the course of the conversation and the investigation, it turns into a shouting match. As I understand your position, when the person's standing there with the knife in the boot and the conversation begins, there's no crime. But as the conversation continues and turns into a shouting match, the person shouting with the knife in their boot has committed a crime.
CCDW, even without committing another crime of resisting arrest at that point.
Is that
at some point, without ever getting into the physical confrontation. Having to draw the line somewhere, I would say no. No, you can certainly argue with the police. But I'm wondering
so
if...
So you can shout, and so there, I just really want to understand how we're going to apply this, if we're going to go with your as-applied argument. So you still haven't committed a crime if it's shouting, but to the extent there's any physical interaction, then that turns the boot, the knife in your boot, into a crime.
Well, the physical interaction would be, as soon as the physical interaction starts, now there's a crime of violence going on, and the defendant is carrying a concealed weapon. And that's just the kind of situation that the CCDW statute is designed to prevent from the point of view of the police officer.
Is it a criminal act to shout at somebody in your home, and even use profanity, and even spit in your home? Is that a crime?
Well, it's a crime to spit at somebody
in the home.
If I come, Justice Steele, you invite me to your house, and I walk in the door and I spit on you. I mean, that's at a minimum offensive touching.
If you come to my house, yes.
But if
I'm in my house and I spit out of anger, you're suggesting someone else is present. You're suggesting that I've committed a crime.
No, my understanding here was spitting at the police. So that would be at a minimum offensive touching.
Is your argument premised on violent conduct? What if the person has a switchblade knife in the left pocket and contraband in the right pocket? Is it now a violation of the concealed?
Right. Now, that would be possession. Now we're in that other possession during the commission of a felony, which is an entirely different area. I remember thinking back of all the possession during the felony drug cases. Now, these guns are usually concealed somewhere, and the only issue that ever comes up in those cases is accessibility. Is the gun possessed during the felony? And I don't recall any of those cases where anyone was ever charged with CCDW because the gun was, say, under the sofa. I know there was one under the sofa case. I don't recall any of them. The only time you find CCDW is when it's in a car, under the seat, something like that. That's when it's out and about being transported. And again, let me emphasize that, go back to what I said at first, with my straw poll of other deputies, the universal reaction was, what? What? In the house? What? And the court considered it, I think it was the Stevens case, the Oregon case. Well, what is the public interest in this? And there is no public interest in this, usually. If you have a gun and you keep it in the house, you can put it wherever you want. If you like to pretend you're James Bond, you can get a shoulder holster and conceal it if you're in your house doing this. It becomes a matter of public safety when we're outside the house, and it becomes a matter of public safety, or at least police officer safety, when the police have to go in the house to make an arrest or something of that kind. Now,
I guess the one question is, are we to assume a total lack of discretion on the part of police officers? They would feel compelled to arrest someone for carrying a concealed deadly weapon in the home when they had a host of other crimes for which they could effect an arrest? Why did they add this one under these circumstances? Wasn't resisting arrest harassment enough?
The police, it was assault second and CCW, I'm sure the police were thinking that this was the trend. They had him in the police car, they drove him all the way to the hospital, he was in the hospital, and all the time he had a concealed weapon. I'm sure that's what they were focused on. I'm certain they were focused on that. Whether this entire incident would have stayed in the home by the time the police had actually found the weapon, I doubt very seriously anyone would charge him with that, because he was in the home. Again, like I say, most people, when they think of the CCDW statute, they think of outside, in the public, walking down the street, driving down the road in your car.
And some people think that voluntarily carrying it, or to use your term, bearing it on your person, going from one point to another, is properly policed because of the implication that it might be for the purpose of committing a crime, or is at least available for the purpose of committing a crime. But when one is involuntarily removed from the home without circumstances under which they would safely remove the knife from their possession, how does that become the equivalent of carrying a concealed deadly weapon in the public?
No. This is what distinguishes the case. Well, that's Dickerson case, where the defendant voluntarily stepped out of his residence, mobile home. And the court said, well, because he voluntarily stepped out rather than being involuntarily removed from the home, that he's guilty of CCDW the moment he crossed the threshold. Even though he was given chance by the officer who was standing outside to say whether he was carrying a weapon and refused to. But in this case, even though the defendant was involuntarily removed from the home, Judge Coots said that under the circumstances of this case, where the violent confrontation, and it was violent, started inside the home while the defendant was armed and instigated by the defendant, balancing the rights conferred by Article 1, Section 20 against the real public policy interests of Section 1442.
Based on what you're saying, Judge Coots found that the offense occurred within the home.
Within the home, yes, definitely. Judge Coots did not consider after it crossing the threshold. I think he was very clear. I thought he was very clear that he was saying the offense occurred in the home. That's why I have to address the home carry possible exception. No, he did not take the Dickerson approach.
Do you agree or disagree that if we adopt the Hamden rule, that that is a matter for the jury to decide, not Judge Coots?
I had not thought about that. Well, the judge, interestingly enough, in this case, the jury is the one who raised the issue. They were given the standard instruction again after they raised the issue, and they were not. Again, because the issue hadn't come up during the trial, they were not instructed as to any possible, constitutional questions. And they were certainly not instructed to find when the crime of resisting arrest occurred.
Is this a constitutional defense that's for the jury to decide or the judge?
The jury, of course, has to decide whether the offense occurred. I think Judge Cook mentions we're not sure from the jury's verdict whether they decided it occurred in the home or outside the home. We just know that they decided that he was guilty of carrying a concealed deadly weapon. Now, where exactly that offense occurred, we don't know, according to the jury. We do know the jury, of course, wrote the jury note, Ray, clarification, carry concealed deadly weapon in the home. So the jury zeroed in on this issue, the issue we have here today, the one that the lawyers had missed. I haven't thought about it. I really can't give an intelligent answer, so I probably ought not to give any answer at all.
Can I ask you on a different subject in terms of drawing the line? And you're suggesting that the line should be drawn at some sort of forcible confrontation with authorities as being the time at which the constitutional protection is overcome.
That is Judge Cooch's position, and I'm going to make it mine also.
Okay, so my question is this. Why shouldn't it just be that you have the protection under the Constitution to carry this weapon in your home. The police come and they're taking you out of your home. The police have to ask you, do you have a concealed deadly weapon? Because if you don't give it up now, we're going to charge you with an additional offense, you know, once we take you out of this house. And the guy says, I don't have anything, at which point the police forcibly remove him from the house and find a concealed deadly weapon and charge him with it. Why would that be inconsistent with the way the statute and the Constitution operate?
I would say it's not. I would say in that case, the guy's guilty. I mean, he had every opportunity to get rid of the gun, to get rid of whatever weapon it was. Certainly the police, in your scenario, have explained to him the consequences of not revealing where the gun is or the weapon. And in that case, he's guilty. Not necessarily in that case. He's guilty of carrying the concealed deadly weapon outside the house.
Well, our problem is we don't know that the jury concluded that the lack of response from the trial judge to their question suggested to them that it was a crime to carry it concealed in your home.
And
we know that Judge Cooch has found, as a matter of fact, that it was in the home where the crime occurred, not outside it, because he neglected to voluntarily disclose that he had the knife in his boot, or in the alternative, lied about it being in the basement. Correct?
Yes.
So how could we be comfortable with this verdict under those circumstances?
Well, we don't, and Judge Cooch points out, we don't know what the jury found. They found he carried a concealed deadly weapon, but whether they found that the crime was outside, whether the crime was inside, or both, we don't know. We just don't.
But what we do know is that they were left by the pattern instruction with the suggestion that it made no difference whether it was inside or outside. Guilty either way, if he was carrying it concealed.
Well, this is true. This is true because the pattern jury instruction, basically the Delaware statute, unlike statutes in most states, don't have statutory exceptions to the general prohibition. Delaware is one of the few states that has that blanket prohibition. Against ever carrying a concealed deadly weapon. So if you read the pattern jury instruction back to the jury, which is what Judge Cooch does, it doesn't give them any guidance. It doesn't tell them, well, it's okay here, but not there. And say, well, the defendant had it in the house, but then he had it outside the house, and it was his own fault that he had it with him outside the house. So if you find, you know, there's no instruction like that, so zero in or on exactly what they did find. So there's three options. Inside the house, they found outside the house, or they didn't care which. They did both. It began when he concealed it when he was in the basement, and it ended at the hospital.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Based on the questions from the court today, it's rather clear that where the line is drawn in the sand is where the problem lies here. According to Judge Cooch, his opinion indicates that Mr. Griffin loses a constitutional protection at the moment of confrontation. That is too premature. As the examples given today, a shouting match is enough to lose the constitutional protection to bear arms. It goes too far. The second problem with the opinion, which the court has also expressed, is this balancing test, that's essentially what it is, it's a case-by-case analysis, is being done by the court, not by the trier of fact. If Judge Cooch wanted to follow Hamden, Hamden tells us what to do and how to address a jury or the trier of fact in this situation, and that wasn't done. As Justice Ridgely, pointed out, even under both scenarios, there's a problem here. Either the all-or-nothing approach, you have the home possession exception, and you're protected, or, at the very least, it's got to be decided by a jury. But what we have here is a de facto non-jury bench trial on the issue of carrying a concealed deadly weapon. And I would also add that Mr. Griffin was acquitted of assault second degree. So the facts are not as clear as to the, I mean, we know it was a domestic dispute. We know that there was some shouting back and forth and, there was a resisting arrest, but he was acquitted of assault second degree. It was a credibility contest. He testified on his own behalf. And the jury believed that there was no assault. And they wanted to know whether he was in violation of carrying a concealed weapon in the home. And they were confused about that. And it would have been proper, obviously hindsight's 20/20, but it would have been proper to address the issue then, not post-trial with an opinion deciding right then and there his guilt and innocence. Unless the court has any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.